We're holding on Kof Ayin Beis Amud Aleph, the third line. We've been learning the whole discussion about predated and postdated shtaris, where we said with the shtar choiv, if the shtar is predated, that can cause real problems as far as the shibud and all that, and therefore such a shtar is possible. What to what extent is possible? We discussed, and then you have as far as various other kinds of shtaris. What there could be problems with if they're misdated. So the Gemara continues. Omelahu Rava Bar Rav Shila Lahanu Kasvi Shtore Akna Yosa. Rava Bar Rav Shila, or on the side over here, it says we're really supposed to be Rava Bar Rav Shila, who we find in various places in Shas. Anyway, he tells people, the Sofrim, who are writing Shtore Akna Yosa, meaning a star for something where there was a kinyan done on a certain thing. So, for example, the Rashbam says here we're talking about it's a shtar matana. Now, till now we've been talking about a shtar halva or a shtar mecher, where a field was sold, and we said we learned before that with a shtar for a sale of a field, then you have, even if it's post dated, is also no good, because we said there could be a whole thing over there where he sold the field, then we sold it to him back, and then he's going to pull out his shtar and say, "Look, you sold it to me again." So even a post-dated shtar for a sale of a field is no good. Now, though, so you can have, what if it's not a sale? What if it's a matana? So then there's no achrayus in that. So then there's no, one consideration also we've been learning the last couple of dafim is that also where there's achrayus involved, then having the shtar misdated is also a problem, because that causes trouble with the for the lakuchas. So now let's say we're talking about either it's a shtar matana, so there's no achrayus to a matana, so there's no problem with that. Or another possibility would be a shtar mechira where there is achrayus. Now the fact is that Rashbam explains that when it comes to a halva, we say people often borrow money in private, therefore it doesn't become well known unless there's a shtar with edim, and then it becomes well known enough that other people are going to know there was a halva, and they're going to know when they buy property from him to be careful because there's a shibud on it. Without that, without the shtar, you wouldn't have that. But here, when you're talking about a sale where there is a achrayus, then sales are usually done publicly, and therefore it becomes well known enough that he did it, that people will know that there's a shibud out there because of the achrayus. So now, Rav Bar
Rav, when there's a shtar, is it the call is known because there's a shtar or because there's edim?
Well, the shtar has to have edim on it.
That's the point. My question is, what is it that makes it public? The shtar or the edim?
It's the edim. The Rashbam uses the expression. So here, when we're talking about a sale, the Rashbam explains, when it comes to a shtar mechira, then the Rashbam uses the expression, the edim mapkele lekola b'loy shtar. Even when there's no shtar, the edim will give out the koil. When it comes to a halva, no, there you need a shtar. There a milval peh does not have that kind of koil. Because again, the difference being that halva is often done in private, just because there's edim who saw it, and usually there are going to be edim because you don't want the other guy to deny it later on, doesn't mean the edim are not necessarily going to put out the koil, because after all, it was done in private. But a sale, which is done in public, then the edim themselves will put out the koil, even if there's no shtar.
And a shtar without edim is not valid?
A shtar without edim is, unless you say edim, if you say edim is sira kauti, if you say, as we've talked about before, primarily in Gittin, and we touched on it the last couple of blocks, if you say that the edim is sira are the primary thing, then fine, maybe you can get away with a shtar without edim as long as you have edim is sira. But of course, it means that every time you want to pull out that shtar, it means you're going to have the edim to show when it was given, so it's not really practical. Okay, so in this case, again, we're talking about a shtar that has a kinyan in it. And we're talking about, again, where there's no issue of either it's a matona where there's no achrayus, or it's a mechira and there is achrayus, but we're talking about that the edim themselves will give out the koil. So now there's a kinyan written in the shtar. So Rava or Rava Bar Shila tells the Sofrim, ki kasvitu shtore akniyosa. When you write these kinds of shtores that have a kinyan, iyad itu. Now, sometimes it can happen that the kinyan is not done on the same day the shtar is written. So he tells them, if you remember the actual day when the kinyan took place, kisvu, then that's what you should write. Write the date of the kinyan rather than the date that the shtar is being written. Because the consideration is, because otherwise the after that kinyan, he may have sold it to somebody else, which he wouldn't be allowed to do. It's not his to do anymore. So now you have to write the day of the kinyan so that so that he'll be able to, so that the recipient of the so that the recipient, the proper recipient, will be able to hold on to it. So now so the Rashbam brings in some detail over here again. The Rashbam brings in some detail over here that there is, again, is there a difference in that regard between shtarei halva? So he brings in at some length over here that when it comes to a shtar halva, then you have to write the date that the shtar was written, because otherwise it's going to be a shtar muktam, it's going to be a predated shtar. But then again, he goes on at length and discusses the various ins and outs of that, and he says that Rabbeinu Hananel would say that actually, that with any kind of shtar, as long as the aid of Rabbi Hanana learns that this statement of Rabbi Bar Shila applies to any kind of shtar, even if you have the kinyan was done on one day and the shtar is being written later on, then it would be the same thing. Only by a get do we find that it has to be written and signed on the same day. But then the Rashbam says, I don't agree with that. I would say that there's a difference between halva versus the other kinds of shtaris, like we said before. Anyway, so if you remember the day that the kinyan took place, kisvu, then that's the date you should write. The iloy, if you don't know the exact date that the shtar took place, even if you have a rough idea when it was, don't write that date. Kisvu yoyma de kaimitu bay, then write the date that you're actually standing in right now when the shtar is written. Kihechi dole mischazi kishikra. So that it doesn't look like a lie. If you write a date and it turns out that wasn't the actual date when the transaction took place, then it's going to look like you're writing a lie in the shtar, and you shouldn't be doing that. So therefore, so if you remember the date of the kinyan, then fine, that's one thing. But if you're not sure about it, then don't do that in the first place. Okay. Similarly, also, and since we're talking about mechzi kishikra, about this kind of thing where it might look like a lie, so the Gemara brings another example of that. Of omalahu Rav Lasafre, Rav said to his soifrim, who were writing shtoris for his beistin, v'chein omalahu Rav Huna Lasafre, similarly Rav Huna told the soifrim who are writing shtoris for his beistin, if you're standing in Shili, which is the name of a town, when you're writing a shtar, no matter what kind of shtar, kisvu b'shili, then write that the shtar is being written in Shili. Even though the instructions to write the shtar were given to you in Hini. Hini and Shili are two towns that were fairly close to one another. So you could argue, what's the difference? It would be like the equivalent, say, of Brooklyn and Manhattan. Is there really that much of a difference? So he's saying, yes, there is a difference. You know, again, you want to make sure it shouldn't be Mexica Shikra. It shouldn't look like a lie. So therefore, write the location where the shtar is being written. Now you would say, in the shtar, in Shili, we're writing down that we saw in Hini such and such a transaction took place. That would be the right way to do it. Tosfos points out these two places are even within a Tchum Shabbos of one another, so they're very close. Nevertheless, they're still different places, and therefore you should write like that. And similarly, he tells them the reverse. V'chi kaimitu behini, if you're standing in Hini and writing the shtar, kisvu behini, then write that it's taking place in Hini. V'afagav de mesidin l'chol mili b'shili, even though the information that you're doing, that on the basis of which you're writing a shtar, was given to you in Shili, for the same reason, because otherwise, you have the issue of Mexica Shikra. So now the Rashba adds, though, that this would be when you're writing the place where the shtar is being written, then you have to do that like Rav and like Rav Huna are saying. If you're just writing where the instructions were given, then you don't need to necessarily add anything else. You just say we were given instructions in Shili to write such a to do such and such. And then you have if they do write the other place and they don't make it clear that it's being written here and the instructions were given there, so then you have a machlokas rishonim whether the shtar is kosher or not. In any case, the point is, as much as possible, in a shtar, we want to avoid issues of mechzik shikra. We're going to write something which is going to look like a lie. Later on, somebody is going to come and say, wait a second, I know when this happened or where this happened, and it wasn't here. And then they're going to think the whole shtar is invalid, and they're not going to realize, for example, that, yes, the instructions were given here, the transaction took place here, but the shtar was written elsewhere, so therefore avoid that kind of thing. In the same way with the previous statement of Rabbi Bar Shila, as far as the dates, same idea. We don't want to have, they're going to write the approximate date when it took place, and later on somebody's going to come and say, wait, I know that it wasn't on that day. I know, you know, you could even say on that day, Manu HaYisem, you were with us elsewhere, whatever the case, even if you don't have actual Hazama like that. Nevertheless, you still want to avoid that kind of thing where Shtar is going to be impeached on grounds like that. Okay. More on the topic of shtaris, the Gemara says, Omar Rava, Haiman de Nokit Shtara by Meir Zuzi. Suppose that the Malve has a shtar that shows that he's owed 100 zuz. The Omar, and he says to Edim, Shavya Nihali Tre Bnei Chamshin Chamshin. You know what? I don't want a shtar of one, I don't want to have a shtar of 100 zuz. Instead, write me two shtaris, each of which says that I'm owed 50 zuz. The theory of it being that this way, I know the loiver may not be able to pay me off all at once. He may pay me piecemeal. And then we have the whole question on our mission, as we had in our Mishnah, what you do in that case, whether we write a shover according to Rabbi Yossi, or whether whether the loiver can say in that case, then I'm not going to pay off until I have the whole, till I have all the money, so you can return me the shtar. So the malva may say to himself, you know what? Let's forestall the whole issue to begin with. We'll write it as two shtaris of 50 each. And that way, if he pays all 50, I'll be able to give him back one of those shtaris. Rava says, loima shavin in lahu, we cannot do that unless the loiver agrees as well. Now we're talking about, Tosfos explains at the end of all of this, if we already know that he paid, then for sure we can't do it. Not if we know that he paid, rather if we don't know for sure that if we're talking about over here, we know that he didn't pay yet. Nevertheless, we can't turn the one shtar of 100 into two shtaris of 50 without the loiver agreeing to it as well. So actually you have the Ritva points out about that anyway, we learned a couple of blots ago, where we learned actually yesterday, that once the Edim have done their shlichus, they can't make another shtar without the loiva's permission anyhow. So therefore we have to be talking about over here, they didn't even sign the shtar yet. But then the Nesivus and the Tumim say that no, you could talk about that you want to have new shtaris that have the original date, and yes, it's true that Edim anyway can't do that, but the point is that even Beis Din can't do such a thing, even though, as we learned before, Beis Din has greater powers. Nevertheless, even Beis Din cannot do that unilaterally without the loiva agreeing as well. Why is that? On my timer, Avdu Rabbanan Milsa, the Nichalei LaMalva v'Nichalei LaLoiva, because this way, it stands to benefit both the Malva and the Loiva in various ways. In other words, having a shtar of 100 rather than two shtaris of 50, in some ways, is an advantage for each one of them. How so? Nichalei LaMalva Kadesh Yakov LaPorei. It's better for the Malva, because that way he has more of a basis for getting the Loiva to pay, as we learned before. It means, for example, when people know that there's an outstanding shtar of 100 on the Loiva, then it means that people are going to think he's going to have to eventually sell his property at cheap prices, and therefore they're going to offer him less for it. So that's a benefit for the Malva, because that way it makes the Loiva think, you know what, I don't want that, so therefore let me pay off as soon as possible. It means that this way, in case he does have to take a shover, he knows he has to watch it, and that way he's more likely to pay off the whole chayv, so he can get back the shtar chayv and rip it up, and the various other reasons that we talked about before, why there's more likely for him to feel pressure to pay off when there's a shtar of 100 rather than when there's two shtaris of 50. And furthermore, we also talked about, for example, this way the loiva might pay off part of it and not be in any hurry to pay off the rest of it, etc. So like this having one big shtar of 100 forestalls all of that. On the other hand, the loiva also has an advantage, because if he does pay off part of the loan, like this, if there were two shtaris of 50, fine, it means he's getting back one shtar and he can rip it up, but the other shtar is completely outstanding. That means if he comes later to Beis Din and the malva says you haven't paid me anything, then the loiva is going to have to swear shvur minatora if he's moed b'miktzas, shvur midrabanan, shvur heses if he denies the whole thing. But like this, if part of the shtar is paid off and the malva comes to Basin and says, yes, it's true, part of it was paid off, but he still owes me the rest, that's called pergim shtore. That's called that now he's saying there's a, so to speak, there's a flaw in his shtar, that even though the shtar says 100, at this point only 50 of the loan is outstanding. And the din is, in that case, the malva has to swear that he's still owed that money and before he can collect with it. So therefore, so that's an advantage for the loiva by having one shtar that says 100. If he does pay off half this way, before the malva collects anything from him, the malva will have to take a shvur. So there's advantages to both of them in having a shtar of 100. So if the malva wants to change it into two shtaras of 50 without the loiva's permission, then he can't do that. Because the loiva can say...
It's a different halacha than modas biktsas.
Than modu b'miktsas. So modu b'miktsas is the other way around. Modu b'miktsas is where the malva says you still owe me 100, and the loiva says, no, I only paid you 50. So then the yesef swear shvuas ha-torah of modu b'miktsas. Here we're talking about the other way around. The malva comes to Beis Din and says, you still owe me 50 from the 100 that I lent you. And pull out your shtar, let's see, and the shtar says 100. So Beis Din says to him, well, you know, since the shtar says 100 and you're claiming that 50 of it was already paid off, that means that it's called pergim shtore. That shtar, in a certain sense, has a flaw in it because you're not claiming the exact amount it says in there. So therefore, take a shvuah first that he hasn't paid you the rest, and then we'll go from there.
So why is the halacha different in each way?
Because there's a difference. When the loiva is moed b'miktsas and the malva is saying you owe me the whole thing, the Torah says, and the Gemara mentions in a few places the point that the loiva is that Eino de Meis Ponov Pnei Baal Choyva, he doesn't have the chutzpah to deny the claim to the faces of his Baal Choyv, so therefore he can't deny the whole thing, but he doesn't want to admit to the whole thing because he can't afford to pay it right now, so he figures to stall for time. So this way the Shvur makes sure that he's not going to try to get away with it. So he'll say, yes, he'll eventually, because he'll be afraid to swear falsely, he'll say, yes, the truth is I still owe you the 100, but I can't afford it right now, so let's work out some terms or something. As opposed to, if it weren't for the shvur, he might get away with it. But again, here we're saying the other way around. The shtar says 100. So Beis Din says to the malva, given that the shtar says 100, but you're claiming only 50, then therefore, so you're not, your claim is not fully backed up by the shtar. Therefore, take a shvur before you can talk about whether the loiva still owes you the 50 or not. Then we have to see if the loiva says, yes, I owe you 50, then good. He says he owes him 50. If he says I owe you 25, then he's a modu miktsas. If he says I owe you 0, then he's a kofa hakol. And then the usual rules apply in terms of the loiva taking a shvur satora or a shvur hesis, as the case may be. The point is that sometimes you're going to have, when we get to Masechta Shavuos, Bez Hashem, later this year, here we're about to start Sanhedrin in a few days. After Sanhedrin comes Makkos, and after Makkos comes Shavuos. So during most of Sfira and a little bit after it, Bez Hashem, we're going to be covering Masechta Shavuos. So we'll deal with at the towards the end of the Masechta. But there are going to be cases where both sides need to swear before a claim can be adjudicated. Yeah. Okay. Onward. So the point is, in our case over here, that the malva has an advantage in having a shtar of 100, but it's not just the malva has the advantage where he can say, well, you know what, I don't care about that advantage, I'd rather have two shtaras of 50. The loiva has an advantage in it as well, nameless matter, pergum shtaray, and therefore the malva can't change it into a two shtaras without the loiva's permission. And vice versa, v'omar rova, ha'iman denokit t'rei shtori b'nei chamshin chamshin. What if the other way around? What if the malva has two shtoris where the same person owes him 50 each? V'omar, and he says, shtavinu niali, he says to the edim, or even to the Beis Din, shtavinu niali chad bar meya, you know what, let's just roll it all together and make one shtar of 100. Loy m'shavin, we also don't do that without the loiva's permission. Same idea, over Rabban and Milsa, de nicha le malva, ve nicha le loiva, because the same idea, we want to make something that's an advantage for the malva and for the loiva. And again, when there are separate shtaris, it's also an advantage for each one. The advantage for the malva of having separate shtaris is you don't have this issue of pogim shtari. If the malva does, if the loiva does pay off 50, then he gives him back the one shtar and he rips it up, and he has another complete shtar of 50, which is a choiv on its own, and therefore when he comes to Beis Din and demands the 50, then the shtar backs him up, and he doesn't have to swear. On the other hand, there's an advantage for the loiva. This way the malva doesn't put him on as much pressure to pay the whole amount, because again, you don't have the issue of a shoiver, you don't have all the other considerations that we said before. So in other words, in short, there are milus and chasernis. There are advantages and disadvantages to each side in having one big shtar or having two smaller shtaris, and therefore the malva does not have the ability to change it without the permission of the loiva. And Omer Rav Ashi, and Rav Ashi says, here's another din in this connection. What about if he has a shtar that says that he's owed 100? He says, you know what? Write for me a shtar instead that I'm only owed 50, because the guy paid me 50. Now, you would think there it would be an advantage for the loiva. Now he's going to have himself a shtar that says that the loiva owes only 50. Nevertheless, Rav Ashi says, we do not make him such a shtar without the loiva agreeing to him. And again, the idea is, and here there's a different consideration that we didn't bring up before. If we were going to write
what consideration?
Well, that's what we're going to say in a second. We're going to explain what the problem with it is. So now that Ashbam explains, where he's saying that write me a new shtar that's still dated the original date of the original shtar. And we'll explain soon. Then Ashbam explains that if he writes a later date is even worse, but we'll get to that in a second. But first, the point is, even if he says from the original date, so you would think, what's the problem? He's saying instead of saying that I lent him 100 on Rosh Chodesh Nissan, it'll say that I lent him 50 on Rosh Chodesh Nissan. You would think, what's the problem? Rav Ashi says, no good. Loy Meshavin and Loy, we cannot do that. My timer, why? Amrinan, because we think like this. I mifra pare, it may be that the loiva has paid off the complete shtar, the complete 100. V'omalei havli shtaroi, and the loiva had said, here, I paid you off your whole 100, give me the shtar, let me rip it up. V'omalei irkasli, and the malva says, I lost it, because of the tavra, and he wrote him a shover, because as we've learned before, the halacha in the end is that in such a case, you do write a shover. Now the problem is, what does the shover say? It says that he paid him 100. Now if he replaces it with a shtar of 50, mapik lehai, so now what happens is the malva later on is going to pull out the shtar of 50, and he's going to say, here, you have a shoiver that says you paid me 100, but look, this shtar says that you only owe me 50, so obviously that shoiver is on a different loan, not on this one, and therefore you still owe me 50. So he can still pull that kind of scam, and therefore we want to avoid that. And the Rashbam adds, so now this is even if the new shtar that the malva wants to have written is going to be dated with the original date. If it's dated a later date, then it's even worse. Then it's even worse, because then you might have that. He paid it off. He has a shover, and then the malva is going to say not only is it a different amount, but that shover is even dated before this new shtar, and therefore obviously you owe me more money. So that's Tosfos points out. In the earlier cases that Rava was talking about, we know for a fact it wasn't paid off, so therefore you don't have that consideration of Rav Ashi's. But you still have the considerations that we said before, that there's an advantage and a disadvantage in having one big shtar or two small shtaris. Rav Ashi is talking about a case we don't even know whether we paid him off or not. And therefore, there is the real concern that we have all of this. So where he may pull this kind of scam to try to claim that he didn't pay him after all, and your shoiver that you're holding is on a different loan, so therefore we can't do that. So if the loiva wants to agree to that, if the loiva says, fine, you know, I'm willing to take my chances or whatever, or, you know, we'll write a shoiver, we'll make sure the shoiver is written in such a way to avoid such problems. Okay, you know, gizn to hate, we can do that, but without the loiva's permission, we cannot do that because of this concern. Okay. Having talked about, so now the the next Mishnah now, the second half of the Mishnah that we're going to learn now is going to continue talking about shtaris, and so logically it belongs in our parak. The first half of the Mishnah is going to talk about dividing up a, is going to talk about dividing up a Yerusha between the children, and on the face of it, it belongs in the earlier Prakim when we were talking all about those dinim. The Rif explains like this. The previous Mishnah, we were talking about that we said you have this question of whether you write a shover or not when the, do you have, what about, we said, you know, if you write a shover when the loan is paid off or when it's partially paid off or whatever, we said there's the concern the shover might get lost and then the Malva might inappropriately collect the debt again. And we said, on the other hand, if we don't write a shover, then the Loiva might get away with it, et cetera. And we went through that whole thing. So here we're going to have, in a similar vein, we're going to have where somebody has an asset and he's able to use it and he's able to use it and enjoy it, and the other partner in that asset is not able to. So we're saying that basically, in other words, it's kind of this yoichal halo v'chadi is the expression we had the other day in the Gemara. Let him eat it and let him be happy. Meaning basically, in other words, in tough luck to the other guy. So therefore, here it's going to be a similar kind of thing. Yerchal alav achadi, we're going to talk about over here, where one of two brothers has the ability to use the asset and the other one does not. So like this, the Mishnah says, Shnei achin, if you have two brothers, echad oni v'echad osher, one of them is poor and one is rich, v'yiniach lehen avien merchatzo beis habad. Suppose that their father left them as a Yerusha, a bathhouse or an olive press. Now, these kinds of assets, and a bathhouse or an olive press, you could have two ways that you use them. There could be a commercial enterprise where they're going to be renting it out to people. In the case of the bathhouse, people will come and pay them a fee and use the bathhouse. In the case of the olive press, similarly, anytime somebody has a batch of olives, they'll come to them and pay them and use the place. Or you could have where they use it privately as something for themselves. In the case of an olive press, they have an olive grove and they use it to press their own olives. In the case of the bathhouse, they have a large enough family with enough members of the family and servants and so on and so forth, that they would use the bathhouse regularly. So now you have those two brothers, one poor and one rich, and they've been left this kind of asset jointly. So, Asan L'schar, if the father, when he was alive, had used these things for rental income, then fine, we continue doing it that way. Aschar L'emtza, we continue running it as a commercial enterprise, and they split the rental fees equally. So the point is, in other words, the Baal Amar makes the point, in other words, that the chiddush of that is the poor brother can't say, you know what, I could really use the money, so why don't we, instead of getting piecemeal rental income from it, instead I want Lucia to just sell the thing, and then I'll have a lot of cash on the barrel head right now. He doesn't have the right to say that. Vice versa, the rich brother doesn't have the right to say that you know what, we'll split up the days. Some days of the week I'll use it myself and my family, because we need a bathhouse, and other days you can rent it out to people. We don't say that. Rather, they continue running it the way that their father did when he was alive.
And that's based on what this idea.
Since their father left it to them that way, then therefore they continue doing it that way. Of course, if both of them agree, then that's different. But we're talking about neither one unilaterally has the right to change terms. Wait, we'll talk about. Let's go through.
Based on which law? I mean, the Torah doesn't talk about that, does it?
The Torah doesn't talk about a lot of cases in Torah Shabbat. That's why we have a Torah Shabbat Peh. But the point is that we're saying, in other words, now we're going to talk about, earlier in the Masechta, there was a long discussion about a concept called good or ogud. When you have an asset that two people own jointly, and it's not big enough for either one to use by himself, one example over there was a chotzer, for example, that two people have a chotzer jointly, and it's not big enough for them to sit down. Now let's say they don't want to be partners in this chotzer anymore. So they want to divide it. They want to say, you take your part, I'll take my part. That had the chotzer has to be a certain minimum size, and the same thing with any other asset, it has to be a certain minimum size to be able to do that. The Gemara discusses earlier in the Masechta, in the first parak, about a concept called good or ogud. Can one of them say, good means pull, ogud means I will pull? So in other words, does either one have the right to say to the other, listen, this place is too small for the both of us, so I either let me buy out your portion, either you pull away and buy my portion out, or ogud, or I will buy your portion out, and that way it'll be belong to only one of us, and then it's big enough for only one of us to use. Does he have the right to do that? So the Gemara discusses earlier in the Masechta, in the first perek, back and forth about whether there is such a concept of gudei ogud. So let's learn through the first half of the Mishnah over here that talks about this whole case, and then we can discuss about what it says over there in the Gemara and what it says in Tosfos and other Mefarshim. So hold that thought.
Is the concept of good and agud is based on precedent? What is it based on?
It's based on logic, that if you have a, it's based on logic, Papashtos. If you have an, you have an asset over here, which is not big enough for either one to use by himself, but that's not big enough for the two of them to use it jointly. Take, for example, a chotzer. Let's use the example of a chotzer, because that's the first example that the Gemara gives over there in the first parak. A chotzer, the minimum size that's considered a usable chotzer, is something that's 4 by 4 amas. So suppose you have a chotzer, suppose they, let's say they yaushin jointly a chotzer, that's 8 by 4 amos, and now they decide, you know what, we don't really like each other anymore, we don't, it's too much of a hassle, whatever it is, we just want to split it up. So fine, they can do that. To either one can say unilaterally, you know what, it's time for us to split it up, and each of us will have a chotzer of 4 by 4. They can. He has the right to demand that unilaterally, and then they build a fence, and you have the whole, thing that it discusses in the first Mishnah of the Masechta. What happens though if you don't, if it's not big enough? So then you have a machloikas. It's actually a machloikas over there, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nachman, whether we say gudei ogud. Rabbi Yehuda says that there is a concept of gudei ogud, meaning that it's not big enough for the both of us. So therefore, so the one who wants to split it can say to the one who doesn't want to, listen, I understand we can't split it because then each of us will not have something that's big enough for the chotzer, but I still want out of the partnership. So either you buy it from me. Either you tell me how much you're willing to pay and buy it from me, or I'll tell you how much I'm willing to pay and I'll buy it from you. Either way, I don't want to stay a shutuf with you. So Rabbi Yehuda says he has a right to do that. Rabbi Nachman says that not. And the Gemara goes through a whole sugya over there about whether to try to prove one way or the other whether that's so. So we'll talk about over here. So let's learn over here, and then we'll talk about how this affects over there.
Talking about one brother doesn't have the money to buy the other one.
So therefore it's a little different over here. That's the point we're going to get at. Where each of them has the money, then there wouldn't be a question. That's the Gemara brings up that exact point over there. So hold on. Let's learn and then we'll see. Okay. So again, so first of all, I saw on the schar haschar la'emtza. So first of all, we said if it was made to be used as a, until now it was being run as a commercial enterprise, then we continue to do it that way, and neither one has the right to tell the other. That I want out of it, and we have to do differently. The truth is actually this I'm saying over here. The Baal HaMor says that you could do that. So the Baal HaMor is saying over here that neither one can say that, for example, let's divide it as far as days or whatever. So the Baal HaMor learns that you could actually even say gudei ogud. In a case like that, the Rimi Gash actually disagrees and says that, no, you can't force gudei ogud in a case like that. As we're going to explain over here in a minute, and in this case, we don't really have gudei ogud in the sense that the poor brother doesn't have the ability to buy it out because he doesn't have the money. So do we still say that the other brother can force gudei ogud, or at least he can force ogud, I will buy it out, or maybe not? So wait, let's learn the cases in the Mishnah over here, and then we'll talk more about that. So again, asan l'schar aschar la'emtza. If they're made as a commercial enterprise, then they continue to rent it out like it was before, and they split the rental equally between them. Asan la'atzma, what about if the father used this bathhouse or this olive press all along for himself, meaning for himself and his family, that is. So then the rich brother can continue to use it during the days that's for him to use. And as far as the poor brother, he can tell him almost as like a joke. You know what? Go get yourself some slaves, and they can bathe in the bathhouse. Buy for yourself some olives and go and press them in the olive press. Meaning, in other words, basically he can say that, listen, it's not my fault that you don't have anything to use this bathhouse or this olive press with. As far as I'm concerned, our father left it to us to use for our private purposes, like he did. So he had enough olives or enough servants or whatever to need it. I also do. You don't have, not my problem. You can't require me to do anything different. So now here's where we get into this whole matter of good or good. So the Gemara brings up the point over there. The Gemara in that sugya on Daf Yud Gimel, when it discusses this whole matter of good or good, brings up this Mishnah over here. And then the question is, why don't we say good or ogud? And the answer is because you only have good and not ogud, because the poor brother can say to the rich brother, good, you pull it away, meaning you have the money to go and buy my portion out, but there's no ogud, there's no, and if you don't want to, then I'm willing to buy you out because he doesn't have the money to do that. So therefore, so even Rabbi Yehuda, who holds of good or ogud, would not say that unless both sides are possible, and here you don't have that. There is a lot of discussion of Rishonim and Achronim and Poskim on this subject. The Rif points out over there that maybe in general, if the other person is not able to buy it, do we not say good or good? So no, you could always say good or good. You can say that if you can't afford it, then I want to exercise my right to buy all of it. But here, actually, the two brothers, it's the other way around. In other words, the Rif says over there, if the rich brother were to come to the poor brother and say, you know what, listen, I understand you don't have olives or slaves, as the case may be, so you're not getting much use out of it. Let me buy out your portion, then the poor brother would have to agree to that. But here it's the other way around. It's the poor brother who says, I want you to buy out my portion, and the rich brother can say, I don't want to. I want to continue. I don't want to spend money on buying out your portion. As far as I'm concerned, the 3 days a week or whatever it is that I have the right to use it, I have no problem using it. The fact that you're not able to use it the rest of the days is not my problem.
Why don't we say something that's a little fairer? Is why don't we force the rich brother to loan money for the buyout by the poor brother if the rich doesn't want to keep
If he wants to lend him money, he's going to hate, but he's not.
No. Why don't we force him to lend?
Why should we force him to? You can't force somebody to lend money to somebody
because
else.
That's fairness. No, he doesn't have assets. He's poor. That's the point.
So fine. So if he can raise money some other way, goes into hate. If he wants to ask the rich brother to lend him money, fine, he can do that. There's a lot of possibilities over here, but you can't force the rich brother to allow the poor brother to buy him out if the poor brother himself does not have the assets for that.
Who decides on the price if the rich brother tries to buy the poor brother?
So we ask, good or good means, in other words, you offer me a price and I'll tell you whether I'm agreeable to this price. You want to buy out my portion for $1,000, tell me, and I'll tell you whether $1,000 is an acceptable offer or not. And the same thing, the other way around.
If he doesn't accept,
he doesn't accept. Whatever. The point is, like any other case where partners want to divide something up. Same thing as anything else. If they need to, they'll go to Beis Din. But the point is, in other words, what rights does he have exactly? Then you have these kinds of details over here. Therefore, we can't say good or ogud over here for the reason, because the fact is we don't have both good or ogud, because the poor brother does not have the assets to be able to buy the rich brother's portion out. Good or ogud, the halacha is we do say good or ogud, but only where each of them has that ability. Now, there are still other possibilities. It is true. The post can talk about, there are possibilities. For example, besides that, he could borrow money from other people. He could also, for example, he could sell his share of the asset to somebody else. And then that person, now the Smeh points out on Shulchan Aruch, practically speaking, another person might not want to get involved over there. Another person might say, you know what, it's you and your brother. I don't want to get involved in a family fight over here, so I don't want to buy out your portion. But if he can find somebody who can do that, gesunt to hate. Tosfos also says, also for that matter, as far as good or good, first Tosfos brings from the Ri that he could offer a lot more than its value and offer good or good. And then the Ritzvah says that no, then in that case, then that doesn't really work, because then all you have to do is offer an inflated amount and then you'll be able to kick the other guy out. So no, Bahashtos would mean you have to offer him something similar to fair market value. What's the meaning of it? The word good is Aramaic for pull. Ogud means I will pull. So good means you pull, meaning you offer me an amount and buy out my portion. Ogud, or I will offer you an amount, and you and I will buy out your portion. So yeah. Okay. So the bottom line is, again, over here, so the Gemara is not really going to be dealing with this part of the Mishnah because it dealt with it extensively in that sugya earlier, but that's the bottom line is, in other words, that basically the rich brother, we're saying in the Mishnah over here, has the ability to say to the poor brother, I have the use of it as much as I'm comfortable with. The fact that you can't is not really my problem. So now the poor brother will have to see what alternatives he has. Maybe he can find somebody else to buy out his portion. Maybe he could convince somebody to lend him money to be able to buy out the other one's portion, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Okay. Next, the Mishnah continues. Naim shohu be'irachas, if two people are living in one city, shem echad Yosef ben Shimon v'shem acho Yosef ben Shimon, both of them are named Yosef ben Shimon, so now neither one is able to take out a shtar choiv and claim that the other one owes him money because Yosef, like this, we don't have last names written in the shtaris. So we'll give them last names for purposes of illustration. So Yosef and Shimon Goldstein will take out a shtar that says Yosef and Shimon owes him money, and he goes over to Yosef and Shimon Silverstein and says, "Nu." And Yosef and Shimon Silverstein will answer back, you know what? On the contrary, that shtar doesn't prove that I owe you money. On the contrary, that shtar maybe proves that I lent you money, and then you paid me back, and I gave you the shtar as the malveh is supposed to do once the loan is paid off. So neither one can take out a shtar choiv over on the other because the fact that whichever one of them has the shtar in his possession, it could be because he's the one who lent the money. Your fakir, it could be the one he's the who borrowed the money, and then the shtar was returned to him after the loan was paid off. Neither one is going to be able to claim that. The Gemara actually further on, we'll learn tomorrow, Beis Hashem, that the Gemara actually is going to bring another consideration as well, why you can't. But here the Rashbam explains it this way, because the Rashbam often does that, similar to the way Rashi does in various places. The Gemara, he just explains what works in the context, even without dealing with the maskana of the Gemara. Later on Kufayin Gimel Amar Aleph, we'll talk about a different reason why neither one can bring out a shtar chayv against the other.
Don't we destroy the shtar after repayment?
No, the loiva is entitled to keep that shtar to use as bottle stopper, for example, or to use for whatever he wants, to use as scrap paper. He doesn't have to whip it up. Yeah. Okay.
So the shtar belongs to the loiva or to the malve?
The shtar to begin with is written. We learned a few mishnayos ago. We said that the loiva can have the shtar written even without the malva present, subject to some conditions that we said over there. And the loiva is the one who pays the sofer. But then once he borrows the money, he gives it to the malva, and it's the malva's possession until the loan is paid off, and then he returns it to the loiva, and the loiva can do with it after that whatever he wants.
So okay. It becomes the loiva's possession.
So it becomes the loiva's when he pays off the loan, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be ripped up.
No. If he wants to, it would make sense for him to rip it up, but he's not required to. The loy achal yochal lahotzi alein shtar choiv, and similarly, nobody else can take out a shtar choiv against either one of them, because either one can say it wasn't me who borrowed the money, it was the other one. He wouldn't be able to collect from either one of them. Because we don't have a raya from the proof. We don't have a raya from the shtar, that is. If there were edim, the Rashbam points out, if there were edim that this one borrowed from that one, then fine, but we don't have a proof from the shtar. Similarly, the Gemara continues, the Mishnah continues, Nimtzal echad ben shtoros of shtoros of Yosef and Shimon Perua. If a person finds a record among his shtoros, if he finds in his files a receipt that says the shtar of Yosef and Shimon is paid off, meaning there was previously Yosef and Shimon had borrowed money from him and from me, and here I'm writing myself a note that he paid off the debt, shtoros shnein pruin, then we consider that both of those shtoros are considered paid off, because again, either one, it could be that it was his shtar. Now, we're going to talk about in the Gemara, on the face of it, one second, we said in the Reisha that you can't bring out a shtar choiv against either of them anyway, so what's the difference whether you have a paper like that? Either way, to begin with, even if you didn't have such a paper, if you brought out a shtar saying, Yosef and Shimon, you owe me money, then Yosef and Shimon Goldstein and Yosef and Shimon Silverstein will each say that it was the other one. So we'll deal in the Gemara tomorrow, Beis Hashem, what the scenario is with that. Also, you have also there's details that the Gemara mentions in Bava Metzia about this, that where Bechlal was, so what, that he finds such a thing among his shtaris. Usually a shover like that belongs by the loiva, not by the malva. So the Gemara explains over there, we're talking about that he found it among his shtaris that are ripped up, showing, in other words, that these are things that he plans to, meaning, in other words, it demonstrates that the shtar itself that it's referring to is in fact void. So therefore, he puts this together with those. So yeah. Anyway, the point is that now, because you have this uncertainty involving the name Yosef and Shimon, then therefore, so you have these dinim. Kate said, Yasu. So how do we do to avoid the problem in the first place? Yeshalshu. So what they should do is write the third generation back. So they're right. One shtar will say Yosef and Shimon ben Yaakov, and the other one will say Yosef and Shimon ben Naphtali. And that way we have it clear. Nowadays, of course, Bepashtos, we would use a last name, would probably accomplish the same thing. V'imhoyu m'sholoshin, what about if their grandfather's names were also the same? Yichtu was Simon. Then write a Simon. For example, say tall Yosef and Shimon borrowed from short Yosef and Shimon, or something like that. Here's another possibility. What if they both what if they both have the same approximately the same build? They're both tall, they're both short, they're both fair-skinned or whatever. Yichtavu koyin. Then, for example, if one of them is a koyin and the other one is not, then they write koyin. And what if both of them are koyin or not? Then the Gemara will deal with that case. But ultimately you find some kind of way of avoiding that. One thing is that Ashbam does point out further on, when we get through the end of this discussion over here, of how we what we do when we have shtaris of Yosef and Shimon. One possibility is one of them could write in some cases one of them can write a hashah to one another. We've talked before in the Masechta about a hashah, a power of attorney that says basically I'm empowering you to go and transact this business on my behalf. So therefore, for example, so Yosef and Shimon Goldstein can write out a hashah to Yosef and Shimon Silverstein that says you go collect using the shtar from Pliny, where it says that he borrowed money from Yosef and Shimon, and if he says, well, maybe it was the other one, then you say, listen, one way or the other, either it's Yosef and Shimon Goldstein, and that's I have a hashah from him, or it's Yosef and Shimon Silverstein, and that's me, and one way or the other, you can collect it, and then we'll deal from there. But we'll talk about that more in the Gemara tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem. An interesting point is why the Gemara uses Yosef and Shimon in this connection. Why not Reuven ben Yaakov or something? Why not Yitzchak ben Avraham? So, but Pashtos, you could say, because the names Yosef and Shimon were very commonly used in those times. We have so many Tanoim and Amiroim with names Yosef or Yosi, and so many named Shimon. There is a very interesting explanation, actually, from Reb Tzadik HaKoyin Lublin, who gives a deeper explanation behind it. He says, you know, we find here in this past week's parasha, we had Shimon together with Levi. They went and they stood up where there was a situation of Znus, the whole thing involving Shrem and Dina, and they wiped out the whole city. Later on, unfortunately, Shimon showed themselves to be not quite so careful in that kind of thing. We have the whole thing of Baal Pa'ur, the whole thing with Cosby Basur and Shlomiel and Zimri and all that. So Shevet Shimon showed themselves to be not so, quite so careful in matters of the Kedusha of the Jewish people and keeping away from the Goyim. Meanwhile, we find Yosef was particularly careful with that. We have the whole thing in this coming week's parasha with Potiphar's wife. So therefore, see, you would think maybe Shimon does not deserve to be like a full-fledged member of the Jewish people after the way they behave. Maybe they lost the Kedusha of Jews. Therefore, we speak of Yosef ben Shimon as if to say that no, even the Yosef, the kind who are extra careful in these matters, like the original Yosef is still ben Shimon. They can still be a son of Shimon because Shimon has not forfeited the Kedusha in that regard altogether. After they tripped up in it, but nevertheless, they still have the Kedusha of a Yid. So the Gemara tells a case.
Is there such a case that a Jew can lose his Kedusha?
Well, that's on the face of it. You would argue that the way Shimon acted, maybe they did. But therefore, that's the Reb Tzadik HaKoyin is explaining by using the name Yosef and Shimon over here, the Chachamim are hinting at it's not so. A Yid always remains a Yid.
Well, that applies to every Yid, that he remains whatever what, he remains a Yid.
Yeah. Yeah. Israel, like I'm Shachot Israel. Oh, yeah. Reb Tzadik himself actually has in another place in his writings where he discusses the point that no matter how badly a Yid has acted, the Eibishter just still loves him no matter what. I mean, we have all kinds of play. We have all over in Chassidus Chabad about that as well, that the unconditional love that you have a famous vort, for example, actually even in Chassidus HaKlolis, you have, for example, a famous vort that the Rebbe Melech Lizhensker says over in the name of the Mezitra Magid, that the Eibishter has an undying love even for the worst sinner among the Jewish people. So here, but Rebbe Tzadik is explaining that you actually have a hint here in this phrase, Yosef and Shimon.
Yeah. He can be a Mumar, he can be a Baal Avodah Zarah, he's still a Yid.
No matter what, he's still a Yid.
Has Kedusha.
As far as a mumer, by the way, there are. I mean, since you mentioned a mumer, there are poskim who held that for certain purposes, maybe a mumer would not be considered a yid as far as matters of kiddushin and gerushin and other things like that. The consensus of the poskim is not so, though. He is considered a yid, but he is considered a yid for all purposes of matters of interpersonal matters and things like that. The exception is that, for example, if he touches wine, then it becomes yain nesach, and there's a couple of other exceptions like that. But other than that, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Onward. It is kind of interesting, by the way, in the Mishnah also that we put writing koyin as the matter of last resort rather than, for example, having that earlier. You would think the first obvious thing would be to write koyin or not before we start talking about their grandfathers or before we start talking about their physical characteristics or whatever. I guess balabatish, I guess you could say that not always are people going to know whether a person is a koyin or not. If you're going to have that, you're anyway going to need to bring edim that he is in fact a koyin. And then if you're going to do that, then you might as well have edim in the first place to clarify who it is. So therefore, so like that's the thing of last resort. Things like his physical characteristics or his grandparents, those are much easier to establish. And therefore, we would rather use those first. Okay, so the Gemara tells a case. Hahu shtar de nafik lebeit dina de Rav Huna. There was a shtar that was brought to the beis din of Rav Huna. Davik siv be ani pliny by pliny lovisi mona mimcha. It said, I pliny ben pliny borrowed a mona from you. Now you have a certain person comes to beis din holding on to the shtar and saying that this is my shtar. That the you who's mentioned it, that the you in the shtar means me. So in fact, the Rashbam refers to the last Mishnah of our Masechta, which we'll be getting to in a few days. Bez Hashem says that if a person brings out a shtar in the other person's handwriting, even without Edim, that says that he owes him money, then that's enough at least to collect from the Chosim Bnei Chorin. It's not enough Mishabodim, because again, you need a koil for that, as we talked about earlier, but at least it's enough to collect from the Chosim Bnei Chorin. So he's saying he didn't write my name because he gave me the shtar. So it's like, you know, in English, you have the expression, an IOU, which means literally you write a paper that says IOU money. So here he's saying that this guy wrote pliny ben pliny, that I pliny ben pliny owe you. Well, then the you is me who's holding on to the shtar. So does that work? Omer Rav Huna mimcha. So Rav Huna says, you know, you have to consider the when it says that I borrowed from you, that doesn't necessarily mean from you as in the person who's holding on to the shtar. Afilu Meresh Galusa. Conceivably, it could mean that he even borrowed money from the Resh Galusa, the governor of the Jews in Bavel. Afilu Meshaber Malka. It could even mean that he borrowed money from the king of the entire Persia, Shaber Malka. So in other words, so how do you know? Maybe somebody else lent him money and he dropped the shtar and you found it. So therefore, no, you don't really have a basis to collect on the basis of this shtar. That's according to the Rashbam. Tosfos says, first of all, the other way around. First of all, Rav Huna is not necessarily saying this as a statement. He may be saying this as a question, which, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, that Rabbah was asked to find a proof for that. So he may be asking, we have to ask, Mimcha, Afilu Medesh Kolosav, Afilu Meshaber Malka, does it mean that the Mimcha could be any of those people? And the question, after all, the Resh Kolosav doesn't usually lend people money. Certainly Shaber Malka doesn't. So in any case, Tosfos explains that Rav Huna means that maybe, in fact, maybe the person who's holding on to the shtar would be able to collect with the shtar. Because even Faker, Rav Huna may be saying, even if the Resh Galusa were to come to Beis Din holding such a shtar, and the Resh Galusa does not typically lend money to people, nevertheless, the fact that it says to you might be good enough because he's holding on to the shtar. So then you have another explanation that Ramban gives an explanation that Rav Huna is asking basically, can such a shtar be kosher? Because after all, it doesn't say who it is. So maybe the loiva has not really taken on a shibud. So the Gemara says, Amalei Rav Chista l'Rabba. So Rav Chista, now we find in some place, in a number of places in the Gemara, that Rav Chista was Rav Huna's Talmud Chover, which means he was his Talmud. He was one of the members of the yeshiva. But he was a chover in the sense that in some ways he was on an equal level to Rav Huna. They were both Talmudim of Rav. There were various things where Rav Huna didn't know something and Rav Chista explained it to him. So that makes him a Talmud Chover. It's a similar kind of thing we find, for example, with Rav Yochanan and Rish Lakish and Ravina and Rav Ashi, and Rav Ashi and Ravina, rather, and other examples like that, where we have two people. One of them is the Rosh Hashiva, but the other one is pretty much of his caliber. And even though officially he's a Talmud, in practice, he's somewhat like a Chover of his also. So Rav Chista held that position in Rav Huna's Yeshiva. So Rav Chista says to Rabba, who at the time was one of the Talmudim in the yeshiva, "Puk ayin ba, go out and investigate this. Go and analyze this halacha. Tonight, Rav Huna will be asking you of this. We'll be asking you about this." Now we have such an expression also in Bava Metzia. It can mean two possibilities. It can mean, if we take it that Rav Huna was certain of his statement, as the Rashbam had learned, then it meant Rav Chista is telling Rabbi, you should know, you're going to be tested on this tonight. See if you have something to see what you have to show Rav Huna that what he said is correct and is supported by a Mishnah or a Braisa or something, or on the contrary, that you have a contradiction to it. According to Tosfos, that to begin with, Rav Huna is asking it as a question, then Rav Chista is telling Rabbi, Rav Huna is going to expect you to do your research and find something to show one way or the other what the halacha should be, so go and do that research. Anyway, nafak, so Rabba went out, the pashtus is because, for example, he may have to be looking for brisas on the subject. Not all brisas were being taught in the Beis Medrash. Some of them were being taught in other places, so he would have to literally go out and start asking among people who are familiar with brisas and see what they have. So nafak, he went out, doc, he checked into it, but ashkach, and sure enough, he found the Tanya, a braisa, get she yesh al of Edim ve'en bozman, if a get for a woman has Edim sign on it, but there's no date on it, Abba Shol Omer, well then Abba Shol says it's not necessarily possible. Now you have, but Midrabanan, a get does have to bear a date. Now, strictly speaking, the Rashbam says, the Mishnah in Gittin tells us, such a get would be possible, however, b'diyeved, if a woman gets married after receiving such a get, b'diyeved, then her child is kosher. We're not going to declare the child a mamzer. So now the question is it kosher to use in the first place? Abba Shol Omer, im kosher b'gerashti ha-ha-yoyim. Abba Shol says, if it says in the body of the get, I divorced her today, now it doesn't say what today is, but it says today, kosher, then that get will be kosher. Alma, so we see from that, ha-yoyim, ha-hu yoyim, and enafik le-mashma. So we see that the word ha-yoyim will mean the day on which it's being brought to Beis Din. So it's the equivalent of having an actual date in the get. The reason behind having a date in the get in the first place, the Gemara mentions in Gittin two reasons for it. One having to do with in case the wife is mezana and the husband, she's a relative of her husband, and her husband wants to save her from getting executed for that. So he's going to write a date with her. He's going to write a date, a get without a date, and claim that he had given it to her before the Znus. The other reason is because what we do as far as Paris of the Nechosim. So like this, Abba Shol is saying that if it says that if it says Tayyim on the get, then that's good enough as having an actual date. It means that as of the date, when the get is brought to Beis Din, then that's when we're saying the divorce takes effect.
Would that help because it's done with Edom, so the Edom sort of a backup?
So we're going to talk about that in a minute. But right now, Rabba is assuming that shows that the saying Hayyim is good enough. So Hochanami, so the same thing over here then, says Rabba, Mimcha, Mahu Gavrin, Enafik, Vitusa, Yoder, Mashma. We can say that when it says in the shtar, from you means the person who's holding on to the shtar. So according to Rashbam, that would mean Rabba is saying not like Rav Huna had said. Here Rav Huna had said, Af Mimcha, Afilu Mereshka, Lusav, Afilu Meshabu, Malka, that it means conceivably it could have been It could have been that the Reish Galusa or King Shaber was the lender and they dropped it and you found it. And now Rabba's Braisa would show, no, on the contrary, it means that we do accept that whoever it says, whoever's holding into it is assumed to be the one who lent the money. According to Tosfos, that Rav Huna himself was asking it as a question and saying, on the contrary, should we really assume that it could have been the Reish Galusa, or that it could have been Shaber Malka? Maybe yes, maybe we should say, even if one of them brings such a thing to Beis Din, we should say, even though they're not usually the kind to lend out money to individuals, nevertheless, maybe they did, and therefore, so then Rabba's Braisa would be supporting that and saying that, yes, in that case, we see that according to Abba Shoal, that kind of thing would be fine. So Omalei Abaya, but Abaya says to Rabba, is that really a proof? The Dilma Abba Shoal could Rabba Lozer Svira like Rabba Eliezer, it says over here it's really supposed to be Rabba Lozer. Why? Maybe Abba Shoal holds like Rabba Lozer, Dharma Edi Masira Kauti, where he holds, as we learned a few days ago, and as we talked about extensively in Masechta Gittin, that Rabbi Lozer says it's the Edim who see the get being handed over that are the ones who cut off the relationship between the husband and the wife. Meaning the fact that the Edim are signed in the shtar is not really so important. In fact, according to him, you don't even really need Edim signed in the shtar in the first place. So therefore, by the same token, according to him, it's not necessarily so important to have a date in the get. So in fact, that Mishnah that we just quoted from Gittin that says it mentions if it doesn't have a date, the Mishnah actually mentions there's three kinds of Gittin which are possible, but nevertheless, if she does get married, then the Vlad Kosher. The first one is where there's no Edim, the second one where there's Edim but no date, and the third one where there's a date but only one aid. So Rabbi Lozer says over there, even if there's no Edim, as long as he gave it to her in front of Edim, then it's fine. Because in the case of a get, it would be valid. And in the case of any other shtar, the only reason why Edim sign in it is mepnei tikkun olam. So therefore, so the Rashbam explains in detail over here, the same way as Rabbi Lozer would say that it's kosher without Edim sign in it, the same way he would also say that it's kosher without a date written in it in the first place. Well, very well then. Maybe Abba Shoal is saying that when you write today, so therefore he holds like Rabbi Lozer, you bechlal didn't need a date in it at all. And fine, Abba Shoal would say, for example, he would say that at least you need to have the word hayoim, because otherwise you don't know, he might have been planning to use this get. Maybe he was planning to use this get only sometime later. Maybe he's planning to write the get now, and then he wants to maybe let's say, for example, he wants that it should only be that it should only be in effect. Actually, so what it is that Rashbam explains that Abba Shoal would say you have to write Hayyim to make it clear that it's taking effect as of today and it's going to be forever. It's not going to be a time-bound kind of thing. In fact, the Gemara in Gittin tells us that you have to write in a get the expression min yoima dinan ul olam, that this get is in effect from this day and forever, so that you don't think that it's something that he means that he's only divorcing her temporarily or something. In any case, the point is, Tosfos disagrees with that last point that the Rashbam is saying that the purpose of writing Hayyim is to avoid that. But the point is, in other words, that Abba Shoal would be saying that really you don't need a date in the get at all. The only reason is if they took an olam. So therefore, so according to him, you have a get that says Hayyim, then there's no problem with it. But that's according to him. But over here, don't you have a concern? The fact is, you have to be concerned that the shtar may well have been written for somebody else, and then he dropped it, and now somebody else is bringing it to Beis Din. So how can we allow him to collect the get? So how can we allow him to collect the debt on the basis of this shtar that says mimcha? Where he might not have been the one. He might not have been the one that it was written for in the first place. So Rabbi answers, you know what? We're not concerned that maybe he dropped it, because people are usually careful to hold on to their status. So it's less likely that he dropped it and then somebody else found it. And he says, actually you have in addition also before we get to that point of whether a person might drop his shtar or not. So there are other points as well among various Mefarshim over here that Rav Huna, the Ritva, actually learns that Rav Huna is saying that, listen, the shtar might be possible in the first place. You don't really have a proof that this guy is the one who lent the money, and we're saying that you don't need such specific detail as long as you can infer it from the shtar. So meanwhile, according to Tosafos, the question was whether who the from you is. Yeah, there's some Marshall explains that Rav Huna was didn't know whether we should be concerned that he dropped it or not. Then the Ramban has a different explanation of the sugya altogether. He explains that similar to what the Ritva says, since it doesn't say anything in the shtar, maybe we should say the shtar is altogether possible. And Rabbi is saying, it says Hayom, that amounts to saying that at the day it's brought to Beis Din. And then Abaya is saying that no, Hayom doesn't mean when it came to Beis Din, it just means when it was given to her. Fine, Edim Asira Kauti, according to Rabbi Lazar, so therefore that would be good. But that doesn't mean over here when you have the concern that you can say that it was given to somebody because it says I borrowed from you, but we don't know who the somebody is. It might have been dropped in between. And Rabbi is saying that we're not concerned about that. And Rabbi continues, where do I get that we're not concerned about a star being dropped and then found? So Ditznan, we learn in our Mishnah. Shnaim shoy be'irachas, echad Yosef and Shimon, shem echad Yosef and Shimon, v'shem echad Yosef and Shimon. Each of them is named Yosef and Shimon. So we said neither one can bring out a shtar chayv to claim that the other one owes him money. And nobody else can bring out a shtar chayv against them because, as we said, each one can claim that it was the other one. Now, the implication is, now the implication seems to be the Mishnah did not mention the point the other way around. Would we say that neither of these Yosef and Shimons can bring out a shtar and claim that somebody else owes him money? It sounds like the Mishnah didn't mention that point, so it sounds like it would be fine to do that. Well, the question is why? Isn't there the concern that maybe one of them had a shtar and he dropped it and the other one found it? So we don't say that. Elalav shma milanafila lechashinan. Therefore, says Rabbi, you see that we're not concerned about a shtar being dropped, because then the Mishnah should have mentioned that point as well. Not only that neither one can make a claim on each other, and not only that nobody can make a claim on them, but that they can't make a claim on anybody else. The fact that we don't say that last one shows that we're not concerned about shtaris being dropped and then found. So what does Abaya answer back? Sure, that one individual person dropped the shtar, that Yosef and Shimon, and that Davka, the other one who found it, was also Yosef and Shimon, so therefore that's very unlikely. But when you're talking about the case that was brought to Rav Huna over here, with a shtar that says, I borrowed money from you, where you could mean any person, anybody who finds it, can claim that shtar. So therefore that's a whole different thing. It's more likely among all the people out there that somebody might have dropped it. So how could we say that the shtar is kosher? Or how could we say he has the ability to collect with it? The Rashbam also brings from Rabbeinu Hananel that Abaya is saying like this: if one Yosef and Shimon dropped it, then he would be going and yelling and looking for it, and therefore the fact that we don't have that shows that the one who has it is the one who is the one that actually had it all this time. But Nefilah Derabim, you don't even know who dropped it in the first place. You never know. You didn't hear one particular person crying out. That doesn't mean it might not have been another person, etc. Because since it says to you, we don't know how many of the people out there might conceivably have dropped it. So therefore, Sir Rav Sambaya says, not really a proof. So if you're going to say then that our Mishnah, you're saying in our Mishnah, you're mentioning two points, that neither Yosef and Shimon is able to say that the other one owes him money, and neither one is able, and neither one can somebody else collect from, but we said they can collect from other people. Now, though, we have a braisa that says, k'shem she'en mitzien shtar choyv ze'al ze'. Just as much as neither Yosef and Shimon is able to bring out a shtar choyv against the other one, Hach en metzien shtar choiv al achirim. The same way, neither one of them is able to take out and collect with a shtar choiv from somebody else. So it means that that braisa is arguing with our Mishnah, but my kamiflegi. Well, then what's the underlying argument between the Mishnah and the braisa? So in any case, the point is, so first to finish off with the previous case, then the point is that Rav Huna would say that we don't, according to the Rashbam, we don't necessarily know that you can collect with it because it might have been somebody else and they dropped it and you found it. According to Tosfos Fakert, Rav Huna is saying that whoever is holding on to it could collect with it. Then we have Rabba and Abaya further arguing that point of whether in fact they would be able to with it or not, or would with a shtar that says mimcha, would he be able to collect with it, or would we say? Or would we say that no, somebody might have dropped it and he might have found it? So anyway, so the point is now the Gemara is mentioning a sort of a side point. Here the Mishnah had said that here from the Mishnah we can infer that either one can try to collect a choy from somebody else with a shtar that says Yosef and Shimon, but a Braisa says that not. So b'may kamiflegi, what is the underlying machlokas between the Mishnah and the Braisa? So the answer is, but Osius Nichnis b'Mesidah Kamiflegi, they would be arguing about the point that we discussed a couple of days ago, which we also had a much bigger discussion of it almost 100 blot ago in the Gemara, and if I involve Ayin Zayin, about whether when you're handing over a shtar to somebody else, is it enough to just give him the shtar, or do you need something more? Do you need to write another shtar as well? So therefore, it's a Tana Didan, Sava Osius Nichnis b'Mesidah. The Tana of our Mishnah holds that it's enough to give over a shtar, all you need is Mesidah, you give it over to the other one. Therefore, so yes, if the shtar was written that the money is owed to Yosef ben Shimon, to Yosef ben Shimon Goldstein, and he gave it to Yosef ben Shimon Silverstein, then that would be fine. Yosef ben Silverstein now owns that shtar, and therefore, so now, by the same token, then he would have the ability to say to begin with, it's not that it was sold to me, this was my shtar all along. The Tana Bara Savar, in Osius Nichnis b'Mesira, whereas the Tana of the Braisa holds that no, to give over Osius, to give over a shtar, it's not enough to do Mesira, so that you need something else. You need a shtar to go with it or something. So therefore, the loiva could say, you're bringing me a shtar that says that I owe you Yosef and Shimon money. How do I know it's you? Maybe it's only pikkudin by you. So fine, they can write a hashah again, as the Rashbam points out, they can write a hashah. Each one can write out something to the other one to say that I'm collecting either on my own, either for myself or on behalf of the other guy. That would work, but without that, then either person could claim, according to the Braisa, that I don't owe you the money in the first place. The Ramban also points out another possibility. I mean, in any case, why would Yosef and Shimon Goldstein take the chance of giving the shtar, the pikkudin, to Yosef and Shimon Silverstein? Again, if it doesn't say last names or anything like that, then the guy could claim that it's his. So he says that maybe he did actually mean to sell it to him. But again, the Tana of the Braisa would hold that that's not enough. So he would say, listen, if you actually own this shtar, then you have to show the shtar with which you bought this shtar. So that's one way of understanding the machlokas. Another possibility would be both the Mishnah and the Braisa agree that Osius Nichnis b'Mesira, that you could use just Mesira to hand over a shtar. But the machlokas is, when he bought a shtar from somebody else, does he have to bring a raya that he bought it, or just the fact that he's holding on to the shtar is enough? The Tana of our Mishnah would say no further raya is needed. You're holding on to the shtar, you can collect with it. The Tana Bara Savat Sochiraya, the Tana of the Braisa holds that he would have to bring an additional Raya as well, because otherwise, again, somebody else may have dropped it and he found it, or might be a pikkudin by him or something like that. And therefore, if he wants to be able to collect with it, he's going to need to be able to bring proof that he actually bought it. So those are two different ways of understanding the machlokas between the Mishnah and the Braisa, and then we'll continue tomorrow, Best Hashem, and we'll continue with the machlokas amiroyim on that subject within the question of Osius Nichnis b'Mesira. So we talked about that the other day, that Ashbam had pointed out that here we have our sugya, where both Abaya and Rava agree Osius Nichnis b'Mesira, and the machlokas is only whether he has to bring further raya. So that would demonstrate the halacha is Osius Nichnis b'Mesira, but as we talked about a couple of days ago, there are other Rishonim who disagree with that. and saying that no, an osius are not nichnas b'mesira. You do need something else as well. You do need a shtar or something in order to be able to transfer osius, to be able to transfer a shtar from one person to another. Okay. So to be continued tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem.